The Beast from the Sea, the eighth talk in a series on the Book of Revelation, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 26, 2013, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 4 accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're at paragraph 59 in my formatted version, which is part 20, section 2 on page 14. Just a little bit of review. My contention is that when we have the first vision in Revelation, in the major part of Revelation, you have the vision of the seven seals. The vision of the seven seals forms the framework for everything else in Revelation, and arguably, basically, the framework for all of prophetic literature. You have five seals that represent a enduring realities throughout the whole period of time from the coming of Jesus the first time to his second coming. Then you have the sixth seal, which is the major focal event in all of Revelation, the day of wrath, the great and terrible day of the Lord, the day when God comes in judgment to finally settle with his own people, the Jews. Then you have the seventh seal, which I'm going to argue represents what we will later know as the millennium, the time when Jesus' kingdom is finally established on earth, and that's the seventh seal. Then we move on to another vision where you have the trumpets, and in the vision of the trumpets, the vision zooms in time to focus on the end of that period that was covered in the first vision, the time just preceding that pivotal event, the great and terrible day of the Lord. Beginning sometime before that until the end, we have the seven trumpets representing that period of time, so that the seventh trumpet actually is that same event again, the great and terrible day of the Lord. There are warnings in the heavens and on the earth, and then you get the beginning of judgment, where you have a demonically inspired armed invasion of armies coming into the land of, I think, into the land of Israel, and basically subduing the land of Israel and conquering the land of Israel. And then that only, you have an interlude where God delays his judgment, and then finally comes the great and terrible day of the Lord, and we're back to that event again. Now we're in a section where we have another vision. In this vision, this one now zooms back out, and we begin at the beginning, the coming of Jesus, and we spend the time. We take into account many of the events surrounding the time of Jesus. Then the vision is going to fast forward very quickly to the end of time again, and we will be right up at the very last events before the great and terrible day of the Lord. Last week we started that in paragraph 58, where you have the birth of the Messiah and the attempt by, and this whole vision is from the perspective of Satan's purposes. This whole vision is focused on what role is Satan playing in history and all these events that are going on. So he begins with the birth of Jesus and all the attempts of Satan to destroy the Messiah during that time, right up until after the crucifixion and the protection of the people who believe in Jesus immediately following Jesus' resurrection and ascension. And then we get to paragraph 59. And there was a war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, he who accuses them before our God day and night. and they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even when faced with death. For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. And when the dragon, let me stop there, and I'll finish the paragraph after we explain this. Michael, don't know who Michael is, an archangel, but Michael and his angels, whatever that is and whoever they are waging war with the dragon. But the account goes on to tell us what the significance of that is. The significance of that is the way in which the purposes of Satan have been defeated by the death of Jesus. Jesus offering up a propitiatory offering on behalf of mankind, the power that Satan had to bring about the condemnation of mankind, or as the text says, to accuse them. Basically, the image here is Satan functioning as a prosecutor at the judgment seat. So the prosecutor has the goods on us all. And he has a very compelling case he can make for why we should face condemnation, why we should go to our destruction. Well, the goods on us have been removed, because he no longer can make a compelling case that is going to sway God, our judge, because in its place, Jesus has qualified himself to be our high priest, an advocate, who can appeal to God to be merciful to us. Yes, we are guilty, but he can appeal to God to show us mercy instead of the justice we deserve. And the judge will hear the appeal, will hear the plea of this advocate, Jesus, because Jesus has qualified himself to be heard. He's the beloved son in whom God is well pleased. If Jesus wants you in his kingdom, you're going to be in his kingdom. It's as simple and as straightforward as that, because God is not going to deny his son his desire for mercy shown to his people, those who belong to him. So that strips Satan of his power. Satan no longer has that kind of hold over mankind because of what Jesus did. Well, visually, that's represented as a long, no, let me back up. Corresponding to that, I should say, there's represented Satan as being cast down. Now, what is that? I think that being cast down is a symbol of him being stripped of power that he previously had held in the earth. I have maintained in a number of different contexts that I think what you see with the coming of Jesus is a shift in the spiritual ecology of history. That before Jesus came into the world was in darkness. And that darkness consisted of the ignorance and the folly and the inability to see and know and understand who we were and how we were related to our Creator. And so what did we as human beings do during that time? We believed in all kinds of different gods, gods that weren't really gods. We worshiped carvings that we made and stones that we had carved. We were stupid people. But then the light came into the world. And corresponding to the light coming into the world is a curtailing of the lying, deceiving effect of Satan. He has been defeated by the forces of light, Michael and his angels, God, Jesus, however you characterize that. He's been defeated by the forces of light so that he no longer can effectively and compellingly press his lie on mankind. The truth is there to reveal the lie as a lie, and more human beings see the truth rather than the lie and respond to that truth rather than the lie. So the Bible presents that as a dawning, as the light coming into the world and shining into the darkness and dispelling the darkness. Well, I think that's what this vision here is describing, is the time at corresponding to Jesus coming into the world, his death, and the effect that had in stripping Satan of his power, his resurrection, and what that meant in terms of the purposes of God and the victory of God over evil. All of that together corresponds to a time where Satan, who ruled the earth and imposed darkness all over the earth is no longer in control in the same way that he had been. Now, the reason I was an amillennialist before I started reading Revelation is because that sounded like that's what happens in the millennium. Satan is locked in the abyss and is imprisoned in the abyss and unable to free himself to go out and deceive the world. But actually, I think the dawning of the light in the coming of Jesus is what's being described in this vision, not later in chapter 20, the period we call the millennium, when Satan is imprisoned in the abyss. Because in Revelation 20, when Satan is imprisoned in the abyss, he is unable to have any effect in the world. That's not true today. Satan is still active in the world. That's why Peter can write he's like a lion roaming around seeking whom he might devour. That's why Peter can write that. That's why Paul can still seem to write as if Satan has an effect and has a role in the world today. He's not gone. He's not absent from the scene, but he doesn't have the same hold on human culture that he used to have and in human lives that he used to have. His power has been curtailed, but not eliminated, not abolished. Well, I think that's the image here. Satan being thrown down from heavens from a height from which he had greater power is now has to content himself with roaming the earth and having the diminished power of someone who's been thrown to the earth. So in that diminished power, what does he do? And we go on. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, the Jews, I think. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place, where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. I think what's being described here is the time from Jesus, and then ultimately in 120 AD is when the Jews finally get scattered across the whole world, or they begin to get scattered across the whole world. From that time on, Satan's agenda is to harass and persecute the woman, the Jews, the people of God. But being scattered out all over the world, they are somewhat protected. They're not in one spot where they can be annihilated easily. They are spread out over the whole world and are nourished there. So the time, times, and a half a time, again, I think corresponding to another way of getting at the number 3.5 that we looked at, is for this period of time when God's judgment is delayed on an extended scale. They deserve to be judged for killing the Messiah, but their judgment isn't going to come until sometime in our future. So for thousands of years, this time, times, and half a time is thousands of years long, where God is delaying his judgment. And what's happening? Satan is trying to destroy the Jews, but they are nourished in their place instead in the wilderness from the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river that the dragon poured out of his mouth. I can't help but think of the Holocaust and World War II in this connection. Satan poured out water out of his mouth to destroy the woman, and the whole world ended up helping the Jews. Many lives were lost in order to defeat the attempts of Satan to destroy and annihilate the Jewish people in Germany. So I can't, and this is probably not the only time, but God has used all the peoples of the earth, all the nations of the earth at various times to step in and prevent the devices of Satan to kill them. He pours water out of his mouth, but the earth opens up and drinks up the water. So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. That seems to be, if he can't destroy the Jews, then he will destroy what we think of as Christians, those people who believe in the testimony of Jesus. So this probably includes Gentiles who believe in the testimony of Jesus and are the children of God, in a sense, the true Israel in that sense. If he can't destroy the ethnic Jews who are the chosen people of God, then he'll take it out on that next group that align themselves with Jesus and God, the believers. So I think what he's describing here is a vision that captures the whole period of time, again, from the first coming of Jesus until the second coming of Jesus. This will always be the dynamic and the realities that are taking place during what we've called the Great Tribulation, from Jesus till his second coming. Okay? At this point, then, the vision fast forwards, I would argue. It's much like the first vision, where basic realities that are recurring realities are described early, and now we start talking about an event at the end, and I think that's what we have starting in paragraph 60. And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? And who is able to wage war with him?" There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Okay, remember, this vision is going over the same ground that the vision of the trumpets was going over. So now we have a description toward the end of time of the emergence of this thing that is called the beast. He has the authority to rule that exactly matches the 3.5 years in the last vision, that corresponded to the delay in God's judgment. The judgment begins with the invasion of an army, and it ends with the coming of Jesus again. And we are led to believe that that time period is the 3.5 years, the period where God is going to delay his judgment just a little longer to wait and for people to repent. I think the coming of that army in the vision of the trumpets is the arising of the beast that we are now seeing here. This army is coming under the authority, under the reign, under the rulership of some political power. Is it a political entity per se, or is it an individual? Or more likely, I think what makes the most sense is it is an individual who is the head of a complex political entity. But there is some supreme ruler who is calling the shots here. And sometimes the beast seems to be representing just the political entity itself, but there are times when it seems to be talking about an individual, and I think it's because it's both. It's a particular individual who has power over this complex political entity that is coming up against into the land of Israel. And if we put this vision together with the last vision, is successful. It subdues the land of Judah, at least for the most part. There are the 144,000 who are being preserved and protected, and apparently supernaturally protected from from being conquered and defeated by the beast. But the whole rest of the Jews and the whole rest of the land comes under the thumb of this political entity that is a beast that's coming up out of the sea. Probably coming up out of the sea is representative of the fact that it's a Gentile political entity and not a Jewish entity. The sea seems to represent often the tumultuous worlds of the history of the Gentiles. The land, the earth, represents the land of Israel. But this is coming up out of the sea, so it's a Gentile nation or nations coming up defeating Israel. It has 10 horns, 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. Now, it's striking how similar this description is to that of the dragon in the vision before. There's only one minor variation. The dragon had 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 diadems, 1 crown for each head. In this image of the beast, it has 7 heads, 10 horns, and 1 diadem for each horn. So there are 10 diadems instead of 7, and the diadems correspond to the horns rather than the heads. The way I would understand that is that this is a particular political entity that's being described here during a particular period at the end of history. Satan is just Satan. Now, why is Satan described as having 10 heads and, I mean, sorry, 7 heads and 10 horns? Because the visions want to connect Satan with this beast who is to come, with this political entity who is to come. Satan can be described in all kinds of different ways, but the visions want to connect him with this political entity because this political entity, like others throughout history, have been satanically inspired, if you will. Maybe that's not the right word to use, but satanically promoted, satanically instigated. Well, this political entity will be like that as well. Now, why 7 heads? I'm not sure I can remember all the evidence that I'm drawing on here, but let me give you my conclusion. At this point, I wish I was Walt Disney, but think in terms of a long table out in spread out in front of me, and going from your left to right, you have Jerusalem represented over and over and over again repeatedly. That's Jerusalem in 1000 BC, Jerusalem in 1500 BC, Jerusalem in, you know, at the right points in history. You have a mountain, because later in the vision, this beast, the interpretation of this vision is going to be given. The 7 heads are 7 mountains, the revelation says. Well, what mountains are we talking about? Now, a lot of people have identified the 7 mountains as Rome because everybody knows that Rome is the city on 7 hills. But that makes no sense here, I would argue, in the book of Revelation. What makes the most sense is we're dealing with the Jewish people in Jerusalem. That's the mountain that we're talking about. The mountain we're talking about is Jerusalem, but we're looking at Jerusalem repeatedly throughout history. So Jerusalem, when Nebuchadnezzar came against it and laid siege to it and defeated it and beat it, that's one mountain. Later you have the Romans coming and besieging Jerusalem and defeating it. That's a different mountain. But it's the same city, but it's a different mountain because it's separated in time. It's separated in history. Okay, now, so we have models of Jerusalem repeatedly on this table from left to right in front of me. Now, back behind it, you have this monster dragon guy with 7 heads. And at each point in history, one head of the dragon pops up above the table and breathes down his fiery breath. I guess this dragon has a fiery breath, I don't know. Breathes down his fiery breath on Jerusalem at this point. Another head is rising above the table and breathing down his heavy breath, fiery breath at this point. And 5 times, actually six times in the book of Revelation, there are six heads who are breathing down on Jerusalem throughout the history of Israel, up to the time that John is writing this. Later, he's going to say the heads are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and one is to come. So what are we talking about here? Well, here's a puzzle that I don't know that I've completely and adequately solved yet. I think I have the logic of what this vision is saying. I don't know if I have a nuanced enough view of history to be able to locate all of these. But one very plausible alternative is that the first head is Babylon. The second head is Media, the Median Empire, which basically was in control of Jerusalem after the Babylonians fell. The Persian Empire after that, which replaced the Median Empire when they defeated the Medians and replaced it with the Persian Empire. Then along comes Alexander, who immediately gives his reign when he dies over to Ptolemy. So the Ptolemaic Hellenistic kingdom in Egypt is the next head. And then finally, you have the Syrian Hellenistic kingdom of the Seleucids following that. That would be five times when Jerusalem itself, the mountain, was under the oppressive rule of a foreign king. So that seems to fit. The only problem there is exactly how do you define one of these heads in this vision? I mean, is Alexander different than Ptolemy? If you have a dynasty and several kings that have ruled, clearly the vision is not separating those out. So how do you determine the seams between one head and another head in the history of Israel? I'm not sure I have all the details of that worked out. And maybe a better way to count it would be Babylon, Persia, because the Medo-Persian Empire is really hard to find the seam between them. But Babylon, Persia, Ptolemy, Seleucids, maybe the Hasmoneans are a head of the dragon. I have not been thinking so because they're Jews, but they're renegade Jews. They're Jews who don't really belong. The high priest under the Hasmoneans shouldn't be the high priest. So it's a foreign rule in a sense. So I don't know if the Hasmoneans would count in the same category as Babylon. But you see my problem. It's really defining exactly what's being measured here and having a nuanced enough view of history to be able to identify five different rules that correspond to that definition. And I haven't got there yet. I'm not sure I've got it. But I'm pretty convinced that I'm on the right track, that whatever these five heads are, they are five moments in the history of Jerusalem in particular, where Jerusalem was under the thumb of Satan in the form of the head of this beast whose sole agenda is to crush and defeat the purposes of God for Jerusalem and his people, the Jews. Now, five have fallen. One is, well, we know what the one is. That has to be Rome, if writing in the time of John. So one is, and then it gets really tough, and one is to come. Has there been another head of the beast ruling over Jerusalem since 120 AD until today? Maybe not. You know, maybe, and he's the text, not this text, but the one coming up a little later, says something interesting about the seventh one. When he comes, he must remain a little while. Not sure what that means exactly. Does that mean a little while, or does that mean a long while? You'd think it would mean a little while, but it could very well be that we haven't seen it yet because it's going to be just a very fairly brief momentary thing right toward the end. So it may be that the seventh head of the dragon has not even emerged yet. I mean, there's a long history of Jerusalem from 120 AD, but notice there hasn't been a temple there. So maybe that's one of the criteria that the head of the beast is foreign control over Jerusalem that is the religious capital of the Jews as indicated by the temple that is there. If there ain't no temple, there ain't no religious capital for a Gentile beast to oppress. So it may be that it has not come into existence yet. Or maybe one of those periods, is it the British? Surely not. Surely it can't be the British, but maybe. Is it one of those caliphates that traded possession of Jerusalem over those many, many centuries? One of those caliphates, were they the head of the beast? Well, why them and not the other caliphate then? Because in the vision, there's only one left. Once Rome has fallen, there's only one more left. So I'm inclined to think that we have not yet seen in history the emergence of this seventh head. But we will, because then the vision goes on to say, this beast is kind of an eighth. The beast that we're looking at here is not the seventh. The beast has seven heads, but the beast is an eighth king. But it's not really an eight because it's one of the seven. So I think what he's saying is the beast that's being described here in paragraph 60 in part 21, that beast is going to be a revitalized political entity from of old. A revitalized Babylon, a revitalized Persia, a revitalized, who'd I say next? Media Persia, a revitalized Egypt, the Ptolemies, a revitalized Syria under the Seleucids. Any of those would be candidates then, from the standpoint of Revelation. Probably the only one it couldn't be is the seventh one that is to come, because it's going to momentarily oppress Jerusalem It's going to momentarily oppress Jerusalem only to be superseded by this beast, this eighth one that will come in and take their place and take over control of the land of Jerusalem, I mean the land of Israel. Okay, what about this beast? It's going to be amazing in power. It will amaze the whole land, certainly, maybe even the whole world. Notice 62, it was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. So during this time, the agenda of this satanically inspired political entity will be to kill believers. They will slay them, overcome them, and will overcome them. And I think that means to kill them, giving clues that are coming up. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. I suppose that people who see in prophecy a one world government are looking at something like this. I don't think this necessarily entails a one world government. In fact, in all likelihood, it doesn't. But this beast has hegemony in the world. This is the power to be reckoned with, and everybody else is kowtowing to the wishes of this political entity, whoever they are, wherever they are on the whole globe, because every tribe and people and tongue and nation, he has authority over them. But I think the authority could just be the kind of authority that any world empire can have over other nations. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb who has been slain. I think the persecution here is going to be so intense that you're basically going to face a choice, worship the beast or die. Stop worshiping Jesus or die. And I think that's probably the kind of situation that's being described. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. And I think in that rather cryptic comment, I think the point that he's making is what will be the outcome of people who persevere in the faith? What are they choosing for themselves if they choose to persevere in their faith in Jesus? Captivity, death, warfare, battle. You can capitulate and worship the beast and take the pressure off, but anyone who doesn't do that and who perseveres in the faith is going to face the hardship of persecution and possibly death, certainly death or captivity. Okay, let me pause for your questions or comments at this point.
In chapter 13, verse 3, it said, one of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the wound had been healed. I don't think you addressed that.
I did. I think the head represents a political entity, not an individual, but so like Babylon or Assyria. So I think the idea is it's a vision of a former kingdom that had its glory in past ages, but who is so defeated and ground into the dust of history that it just seems miraculous that it would rise again to the level of political power that it has at this time. So take something like Egypt. I mean, 20 years ago, would you have ever dreamt that Egypt would have hegemony in the world? Or Syria, for that matter. Persia might be less remarkable, but even Persia. I mean, their glory days were behind them. They had received a fatal wound as a kingdom and were gone. And yet, if we saw a resurgence in any one of them, it would be pretty remarkable.
You could also say that about Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of creepy. You could say that about Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure what your point, though, is.
Well, but it's just sort of, you know, what if Israel itself is the
miracle?
Some screwball political, government, spiritual entity that becomes Israel, that people just think, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what's being said here, is it's going to be just as remarkable as Israel itself coming into being. Yeah.
Just little details. The use of the word dragon. Mm-hmm. Now, the closest I could find to this was like a large, fearsome creature. But you don't see what we perceive as a dragon in the imagery of the Middle East. You see it in Nordic, Germanic, you see it in the Far East, but you don't see the dragon in the imagery of the Middle East. So why are we...
Okay, forget all that fiery breath part.
Just a big, fearsome beast. And why is it red? Is it a red dragon?
Probably for... it's either wrath or violence, probably bloodshed. But, it's representing this event and his role in this event. So whatever red represents in this event, I think.
Clearly he's a commie. And why is the deceiver called the accuser of our brethren and not our accuser?
I don't know.
Do you have any idea?
I don't know.
Because he's...
Where is that?
59, line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Well, it's a voice from heaven. So I think it's... I don't know what that heavenly voice is, but okay. Some solidarity with saved, redeemed human beings coming from a voice in heaven who presumably is not actually one of us, but can in some meaningful sense be called our brethren.
And when he is represented as the accuser, he seems to be sort of a haranguing voice that wants to convince God to ditch these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that true? I mean, is that how... Because he's the accuser. Okay, I get it. He's the sort of like a prosecuting attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But he never shuts up. He's the accuser of the brethren. In the Old Testament, he's the accuser, the slanderer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who's his slanders and accusations supposed to affect?
I think it affects us. We're the ones being accused. But his agenda is in opposition to God. No, you can't have a people of God. They're unworthy. So no, you cannot have them. They must be destroyed. They must be condemned. So if you had a purpose to make a people to yourself, that's his ultimate motive is to thwart God's purposes and God's desires and God's will. So if God desires to bring a people to himself out of mercy, Satan is opposing that. He's trying to thwart that.
Okay. And when the they persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, but the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman. What's the great eagle?
Did you see The Hobbit?
Could have been the inspiration there. Yeah. Is it just mean, I mean, did they have in their, if you had said the great eagle, would they all know what you were talking about?
Yeah, I probably not, but a lot of the symbols in Revelation, it seems to me, they don't, if they come, if they're known externally to Revelation, I don't know where they're coming from, but I think there are a lot of symbols that get their meaning by repetition within Revelation itself, and eagles seem to be rescue, deliverance.
So with respect to the analogy of the beast's heads being various eras of domination, for lack of a better phrase, you don't restrict that? I mean, the difficulty I have with this is if you just said, well, let's say it's an empire. Well, that becomes increasingly complicated with respect to the modern era because empires are a little more loosey-goosey and it's more about ideology and things. So when we think of these oppressive eras that are persecuting the faithful or in some ways going about undermining the Jews or the people that are good in the Book of Revelations, it doesn't help us then to think of it as a single kind of classification. Like it's not just an empire with a king in head. We can't just say, well, it's Pharaoh, because at some point governments and institutions don't run that way that Pharaoh ran Egypt. And we might, I'm trying to say it in a much more concise manner. To conceive of the beast's heads as a continuum of single things. Like, let's just say that the first head is the Pharaoh, and therefore we look through all history for Pharaoh-like figures doing Pharaoh-like things to the Israelites. Like, so to focus in on a single person being the head of a country that's doing this oppressive work, that gets harder to understand as we move into the modern era and we have ideologies that could potentially stand in for the beast's head. So you could say, well, let's say, Logan brought up, why not Israel? Why can't Israel be the head that has been permanently wounded and comes back and is impressive and therefore casting the Israeli government in a negative light opposed to pick Israel or Germany, but yeah, or we could pick communism. Let's say communism has a marvelous resurgence, although it's dead as a doornail right now. Like, except for China, damn it. But that's different. So how do we understand the fact that what could stand in for the head could be a myriad of various human inventions, human conglomerations of either power or ideology or military power or just deceit, or just simple deceit. Like, I mean, how do we understand this head thing when I like the idea of this kind of chronological, this in this era the Jews are persecuted by this force, this main popular populist idea or actual physical thing like an army. I like that. I just don't know. It gets really hard to understand. In addition to the fact that it seems when we think about the redemption of the Jews and when we think about, as it's spoken of in the Old Testament, are we thinking of that in a political sense, in a spiritual sense, in a geographic sense? Like, the book seems to be so based in a kind of militaristic terminology that it's hard to really gather what it means for the Jews to be anywhere. Like, are they spiritually finally inclined to the Messiah? Are they just happen to be all sitting in the same place in the Middle East where God promised Abraham a million years ago they'd all hang out? Like, there's a number of ways that I don't understand success in the Book of Revelations, and therefore it's hard for me to identify what the Jews are inheriting or when they're in the right position for us to say, okay, that's a big deal that they're there, and vice versa. When I look over the course of human history, it's hard for me to be able to point at a single thing and say, oh, see, Pharaoh was a jerk like this, and I don't know, Stalin was too. And, like, it's hard for me to make that similar connection. I do like the instance for Pharaoh when God hardens Pharaoh's heart. That feels very profound. Like, that feels very, it seems like an instance that would stand out in the Book of Revelations as something measuring where no matter what Pharaoh was, he was determined to be the villain. Like, that was what he was. And so that's a useful sort of instance in the Old Testament where I can say, it's gotta feel like that. It's gotta feel like no matter what they are, their hearts are determined to be hardened against the Jews. But what does it mean for them to be hardening against the Jews? Could it potentially even be the Israeli government right now? Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, those are great questions that have to be solved, and I don't have adequate answers for all of that. you know, going into my study of Revelation, I was expecting that the beast would be some kind of abstraction, materialism, consumerism, imperialism, you know, something like that. But you can't make it work. I can't make it work because when you get, it's not in this section, it's coming up. But when we get to the section where this beast is described again, like, for example, seven, why all of a sudden do I take the seven literally? I haven't been taking it literally up till now. Yeah. So why do I take it literally right now? Well, because he gets to the next vision where he says, well, there's seven, five have fallen, one is and one is to come. Well, five and one is seven. Okay, I get it. You mean seven. Yeah. So there's just all these little clues that you have to, you know, you can ignore them and make all kinds of things work. But it's in trying to make all the details of the vision actually meaningful and fit that I was kind of forced to recognize, okay, you're talking about actual kings who actually were ruling on a mountain, you know, I mean, those words that he uses there, in this order, and here's where we sit in relationship to all those things. The only way I can do that is to see seven relevant kingdoms. I mean, it doesn't talk about the Incas. He doesn't talk about the Ming Dynasty. He doesn't talk about any of the empires in Africa. I mean, there's so many parts of world history that where you would see similar dynamics, imperialism, people conquering people, absolute dictators, tyrants ruling over people. You can go all over the globe and find all kinds of examples. But the only ones he's concerned about are these seven. And I think you've put your finger on it. The only thing we know for sure that these seven share is some kind of connection with the purposes of Satan in opposition to God. So hardening Pharaoh's heart would be a critical piece of that. But the reason I don't include Pharaoh is because there's something about it that seems to require the fullness of God's purposes being revealed and set in place and set in motion before these even become relevant. It's Satan is opposing those. Well, opposing the people in Egypt was to oppose a people that was going to become the people of God. They're not the people who have been entered into a covenant with God as the people of God yet. You see what I'm saying? So as striking as that event is, I'm not sure it's one of the seven. And I'm inclined to think it has something to do with the temple. That all of the six that I mentioned, all of them are dealing with the temple in Jerusalem. And what's the status of the temple? Are they free to worship God as their God without the interference of a foreign power? But I just can't put all the pieces together. And in part, I just don't have a sufficient knowledge of history to know for striking resemblances and differences to stand out to me at this point.
That was really useful. Thank you. That also helps me understand how the era that when he says, and this is one, and he seemed to be intimating that that's the Roman Empire, and then, of course, we know that the Roman Empire is no longer here. So, mm-hmm. Again, that's what's spurring my idea that it must not simply be domination of some kind. Like, perhaps we are still what could be considered the Roman Empire. Like, perhaps, I mean, there's kind of a lot of big stuff happens during that period. The great irony of the fact that, for some reason, the Jews and their story seems to be I wouldn't say restricted, but the pageant of the Jews plays out in Western civilization opposed to Eastern civilization necessarily. Like, and that pageant is married to the invention of Christianity as, I mean, I always want to play down Christianity because I live in America and that's just cool and hip to do. But it's kind of a remarkable thing that Christianity comes about at this period and it's still here and still doing whatever the heck it's doing. And whether it's the beast or it's not, it's still up, that's a coin flip for you. But it's no accident that the Jews' history has been so enmeshed in Western civilization, in what Europe has been doing, and then eventually in how we as Americans relate to the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we have the birth of Christianity at the same period, and that is also extending forward to some point.
Well, that I'm going to see coming up later in Revelation, the Jewish people intertwined with Western civilization. I'm going to argue that Babylon is unbelieving Jewry is Judaism, unbelieving Judaism. And it's described as riding on the beast. And I think I'll try to make the case that I think what he's describing is the way that Western civilization is what it is, in part by the leadership of Jews, and the Jews are supported by and maintained by Western civilization.
So it's a sort of symbiotic relationship.
It's a what?
It's a sort of symbiotic relationship.
But symbiotic relationship that ends bad for the Jews.
Yeah, for the Jews. Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Another comment I skipped over. Notice that in paragraph 60, this is 13, 1 and 2, there are 10 diadems on his heads were blasphemous names. I didn't comment on this. We have all kinds of indications that this leader, whoever it is basically declaring himself God, which also may be a distinctive of all seven of these heads, is that someone is representing himself as divine, who is ruling over God's, you know, Yahweh's house, Yahweh's temple in Jerusalem. A human being who arrogates himself to a position of God has him under his thumb. That there may be something to that. But that's the blasphemous names, are names where he's declaring his deity. It says, and the beast that I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. Well, I don't think it's an accident that we have this beast described in terms of a leopard, a bear, and a lion. If you remember back in the prophecy of Daniel, the lion represented Babylon, the bear represented Medo-Persia, and the leopard represented Greece. So that's one of the reasons why I'm pretty sure of at least four, if not five, of the heads, is because we already have a reference back to Babylon, Persia, or Media-Persia, and then the leopard, which splits in one of the visions in Daniel. It's clear that it has four heads, only two of which are relevant to Jerusalem. It's the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria, who are constantly fighting over Jerusalem. So all of those kingdoms are sort of represented implicitly in the bear, the lion, and the leopard here in this vision. So I don't think I'm completely making that up when I see a connection between those heads and those kingdoms. Okay, you've got 2 minutes for any last question.
About what you just said about Daniel, I was just looking at that passage, and he describes the three monsters. There's the bear, the lion, and the leopard. And then a fourth monster that's different than the others that has 10 horns. I think 10 horns, right? Yeah. So are you seeing this beast as being the fourth beast that occurs, or is it a completely separate beast that the earlier three beasts in Daniel are a part of? The beast in Revelation.
I can't speak to Daniel with confidence because I haven't studied Daniel, but it occurs to me, I think most people take that to be Rome, if I remember correctly. But I'm not so sure. I think that beast in Daniel might be the same as this beast here in Revelation.
And in that case, would you still see the bear, the lion, and the leopard as being kings represented in Revelation? Because in Daniel, it seems like those are separate kingdoms.
I'm not following. What? Say that again.
Because in Daniel, there's the, what you said, the Medes, the, I don't remember all the three kingdoms you mentioned. There's those three kingdoms, and then a fourth one that's different. Whereas when you're talking in Revelation, you're seeing those three kingdoms mentioned in Daniel as being a part of the beast in Revelation.
Oh, no, I don't think Revelation is trying to say that they are a part of it, although they certainly could be, because what we're going to find out later is the beast is ruling over a coalition of 10 kings. That's what the 10 horns represent. So that could include every one of these, of those kingdoms that are represented by the leopard and the bear and the lion and so on. So that's entirely possible. But I think the fact that you have the beast with the feet of a bear and the mouth of a lion and so on, I think all that's trying to do in Revelation is to say it's the same dynamic. It's the same satanic purpose at work in this kingdom at the end of time as it was work back in Babylon and Persia and Greece. I wouldn't take it any further than just to say it's the same dynamic happening again.
Okay. That's helpful.
Okay. I meant to get further, but we'll do that next week. Thanks.